Hi, Henry.
Hi, Megan.
How are you?
Not too bad. It feels like we've had this conversation before.
Just a few times. I think this is actually like the cursed Blogging Heads TV.
Yeah, this feels like about time number 20.
But I think, well, practice makes perfect.
Yeah. But I think our spiel was that I would ask you about the DC weather, and then we would use this as an excuse to get into the topic of global warming. So let's just can the intro and get into the topic of global warming and the IPCC report and apologies surrounding it.
Sounds good to me. Let's shoot.
Okay, so my take on it, it doesn't tell us anything that we didn't know already. It's in that sense, it is it really is just saying that the chances seem to be pretty overwhelming, that this is human caused, and that there are some potential pretty serious problems coming down the pikeway if we don't do something about it. The interesting question is, what are the politics that are likely to come from it? The Bush administration, which I take as a cautiously optimistic sign, has come out vaguely welcoming it and has also begun to try and rejig its record, according to Chris Mooney, in order to make it sound like it was in favor of action on global warming all along. But obviously there are a bunch of international issues connected with the Chinese and others which make it tricky to say what kinds of action are going to happen in the short term.
Well, I think there's basically sort of two issues three issues on global warming, really, at this point, right? One has been resolved, is this happening and is it anthropogenic? The second issue that needs to sort of go through is if this is happening, how much and what should we do to abate it? And then after we've gotten there, and I don't think that there's anything near consensus on that, and I'm not even sure how you reach consensus on that, given the huge number of value judgments that are made in terms of trading off between current prosperity and future prosperity and so forth. But once you've gotten to that point, the agreement that I think sort of most people now have, that probably something should be done, then the question is, what can you do politically? And those two final questions are both almost being hashed out in the same place, which I'm not sure is a good idea.
Well, I think that's true. I also think, I know that you're somewhat skeptical about the European response to this, and in particular, based on the way that Europeans haven't been especially good about what's happening in the Kyoto Treaty and the way that most states don't seem to have met their obligations, and those that have effectively had windfalls of one sort or another which have allowed them to get away with it. But I also think that the European lesson at the moment might be getting a little more interesting. We're seeing at the moment two major Commission initiatives in the last couple of weeks. One, which is a push to very substantially reduce carbon emissions from fuel, or carbon levels in fuel. And the second, which is an initiative to effectively and sort of harmonize green crimes at the EU level, and to have some sort of common regime as to what constitutes a pollution crime and what does not. And what I think this can be interpreted as is as two things. First of all, the Commission, as it usually does, trying to gather power and authority to itself, especially in an era where a lot of its authority and the momentum of the European Union have come under question, thanks to the failure of the constitutional treaty. But the second thing is that I think that there is a recognition on the part of the member states, certainly with regard to the green crimes issue, and to a lesser extent with regard to carbon and fuel, where there is a big fight going on between Germany and some of the southern European countries, in which Germany is trying to protect its auto manufacturers. What I think you're seeing is a recognition that there is a need for some sort of a regime to ensure a common approach on energy policy, and the beginnings of a substantial EU presence here in a way that I don't think we've seen in the past.
I think there's two questions, of course. I mean, the first is, obviously, centralization has certain advantages, especially when you're dealing with collective action problems like the environment. It also, of course, has certain drawbacks. When the government picks one way, if it picks the wrong way, then there's not a huge amount of recourse, and that's something that you've definitely seen in the EU as well as in the United States, that once, you've started to go down the wrong path, you get all sorts of entrenched interests who work very hard to make sure that you keep going that way even if it's not working. But the bigger issue to me is just how far can the European Commission go beyond what its consumers want. And this is something that you see in the United States all the time, right? You get federal initiatives for the same reason that you get EU initiatives, because these things, because environmental issues, for many reasons, it's argued should be handled centrally. And many of those reasons, I think, are compelling. But at the same time, the United States passes an initiative saying by 2025, 50% of our energy will come from renewables or whatever. It's 20%. It's usually something like 20%. And it just never happens. And the fact is the government that enacts these laws can also waive them. And if there is enough pressure from voters, they will waive them. The German auto unions are very, very powerful coalitions. So I'll be interested to see how far they can push that. But even beyond that, if these things start seriously cutting into consumer enjoyment of the mobility and freedom of cars, which even in Europe is growing, I think, almost as fast as in the United States, then I'm not sure that the laws will outlast the voter ire against them.
Well, I think that, first of all, the question to the extent to which there is going to be voter ire about these laws remains to be seen. As I said, that this is something which is hard to say. Opinion polls suggest that people are in favor, as I understand it, of strong action being taken in the environment. Whether or not they like that action when it's taken, who knows? This is a question which I think prognostication is not going to be able to resolve in advance. But with regard to the Commission not wanting to get too far ahead of the member states, I think we've got there's a pretty interesting precedent here, which is Frank Schimmelpfennig has a very nice article in an international organization from a number of years ago, talking about the reasons why the European Union expanded to admit a whole bunch of member states in Central and Eastern Europe, which major member states such as France did not want to join the club. And the reason why, answered the European Union, went ahead and did this was effectively that even while France and other member states were in practice opposed to it, they found it damn difficult to express that opposition in public, given that there was this general sense, this general normative consensus that the spread of democracy to Central and Eastern Europe was a good and wonderful thing. So they found themselves effectively confined to carping from the sidelines and trying to slow down the process, but not effectively able to stop it. And I wonder whether there may not be something like this which may happen if the Commission does, as it seems to be trying to do, take on a greater role and greater responsibility in the area of environmental protection, that it's going to be very, very hard for the member states to oppose initiatives, even when they know that these initiatives, when they in fact don't want these initiatives, because nobody wants to be perceived as being the actor which is directly seeking to deadlock environmental change, responses to environmental change. So that's certainly an optimistic take on things. You could make a negative take on things, but I think that the political possibilities here are not as hopeless as I think you seem to suggest. Because there certainly is going to be some consumer grumpiness and opposition when this begins to hit into what people can or cannot do. But the extent to which people are going to just bitch and moan about it and get on with their lives, the extent to which they're going to organize formidably against this, that's an entirely different kettle of fish. And one where I think that there is more political possibility than you presumably do from what you're saying.
I guess I would just ask, when you look at what happened to Kyoto and to meeting Kyoto targets, including in countries like Canada, which are certainly about as environmentally committed as it gets in terms of having normative consensuses about what should be done, and which passed laws saying, we are going to do this, what happened to those targets is eventually they simply had to be given up because the cost of crossing the huge number of interest groups that were required to really get serious action were too politically high. And so I would simply point to the same thing in the EU. I mean, yes, it'll be great. If the EU can slash its emissions by 20% or whatever is now required to make a serious dent in global warming, I'll be the first to applaud their ability to get it. I'm just skeptical that energy is one of those things that hits everyone. No one is unaffected when you raise the price of it, when you force conservation, when you do all of these things. And it's extremely contentious, even for people who think that they believe in conservation, who think that they believe in reducing emissions, when they have to confront the personal cost of that, suddenly it's extremely easy to come up with a reason why you, Mr. Voter, have a special exemption from the need to do this. I mean, obviously, yes, we all want to cut emissions, but that doesn't mean that I need to turn my thermostat down to 50 and not have a dishwasher and wash my clothes in a cold tub and hang up, you know, all of these things and not have a car. Everyone can agree that something should be done, but they can't agree on what should be done.
Well, as against your Canada example, I can't oppose the example of what's happening with the major oil companies and indeed with the major car companies. There's a very clear recognition in the energy sector that things are changing and that it's, be blunt, that it's better to be inside the tent pissing out than outside the tent pissing in. And when we see ExxonMobil effectively getting on board with things and stopping funding some of the global warming skeptics who they've been funding in the past, this suggests that there's something important changing, that the, you know, that the game is changing, that clearly these interests are going to still have an interest in trying to slow things down, in trying to influence whatever happens to make sure that it impacts their bottom line as little as possible. But as far as I can see, there is a sort of tacit recognition among the major groups involved that the game has changed, and that they effectively have to get into the new game if they're going to have any hope whatsoever of influencing it. So I think that I think that the political possibilities are better than you seem to have.
I guess I would just go back to, to go back to what you said about the globalization question, what I would ask is, what is different, in terms of Kyoto, where each nation had its own pretty clear target, what's different about the EU-level politics that is going to change what happened at the micro level in each of these different governments? What is going to change when it goes up to the EU level? Is it that the EU Commission is simply going to ignore the wishes of voters? Or is there a secret? Because I don't actually see with Kyoto that you do have a big collective action problem. Everyone basically agreed on what their targets are going to be individually, and everyone is missing them individually.
But that is the definition of an international collective action problem. If you read, for example, Robert Cohane, who's the big, in my personal opinion, this is not an extraordinary insight, but this is the big argument on international institutions in the last 20 or 25 years, that what they do is effectively they provide a means of monitoring and making sure that states which make collective commitments that are individually expensive to fulfill, that these states and sort of actually abide by the commitments. And his argument is that international institutions provide the necessary level of transparency to do this. But there is a big difference here between the European Union and traditional international institutions. And it's there's one simple word here, which I think is my answer to your question, judiciability, which is sort of when member states fail to live up to their obligations under the under European Union law, the European Commission can take them to court, can take them to the European Court of Justice, and can sue them. And the European Court of Justice can tell these states that they're in default and make them mend their ways. And this is something where, in fact, there has not been to date any instance whatsoever of a member state refusing to comply with the European Court of Justice ruling. So even under conditions where some of these rulings have been politically contested.
I guess my understanding, though, is that where there haven't been cases of member states failing to comply, there have been lots of cases of member states failing to make it in front of the court in the first place. And I'll go back to something that we mentioned in an earlier conversation, is the Maastricht Treaty, which governs the conditions for entering into and staying in the euro, which has just been egregiously violated. Countries are running huge deficits, inflation is above where it's supposed to be. All of these different issues, and no one's dragged France and Germany into court, even though they've blown their targets, 4 years running. And they don't drag them into court because no one wants to test the mechanism. No one wants to. And I guess I would wonder if a similar thing would happen if this is a sufficiently politically hot issue. If people in Germany, for example, will cause the government to fall if they don't, or will threaten to exit the EU if they're forced to suddenly cut their energy intake by 20%.
Well,
that will just not drag Germany in when they don't make their targets.
But if they're forced to cut their energy, whatever, it's by 20%, that we'll see what happens. But the example, when you're talking about the Maastricht Treaty, you're really talking about a specific part of that, the Growth and Stability Pact. And the reason why the Growth and Stability Pact has not been tested in front of the courts is primarily because the Growth and Stability Pact was a mess to start with. In effect, if you look at the role of the European Commission in the Growth and Stability Pact, the European Commission primarily acts as a whistleblower. Whether or not there are any punishments which are sort of meted out to member states for failing to live up to their commitments under the Growth and Stability Pact depends upon the member states themselves meeting in the form of the Council. So in other words, the reason that there hasn't been European Court of Justice action happening here is because European law has not apparently been violated, at least in the letter. The spirit, you could certainly argue that the spirit of the Growth and Stability Pact has been trampled into the dirt. But the European Commission, if it went up before the European Court of Justice with a case against the member states for what had happened with the Growth and Stability Pact, it would be a somewhat difficult case from my understanding of the law involved, precisely because the final decisions under the Growth and Stability Pact as it was first drafted are effectively political decisions taken by the member states themselves. So it's so this is not, in other words, a good test case for what the powers and limits of the European Court of Justice are, because the Growth and Stability Pact, because it was so sensitive, was hedged around with sort of all sorts of loopholes, which the member states have affected as well.
I think we're taking the conversation a little far afield into the ins and outs of the European Union. So I want to push it back over onto environmental issues if we can. But I would just say that I think for any government, not just the European Union, there are limits to the power to force voters to do something that is extremely personally unpleasant, especially when you're not at war, especially when the crisis is 100 years off and the people who are being asked to make the sacrifices will not really experience much of the pain that comes, they won't make those sacrifices, and probably even their children won't. I mean, you know, most of the people who will suffer from global warming haven't been born yet. And, you know, are you super worried that you're going to cost your child the precious years from 92 to 94? And so I think that's true in the United States. I think it's proven true in EU governments. I think it's proven true everywhere. And I think that the huge challenge of global warming is that you have a problem that's extremely far off, that you have a problem that's extremely badly described. I mean, the estimates are very wide. It's very hard to know exactly what's going to happen. Even if we get it, you know, global average warming, what areas are going to be hurt. You have disparities between who gets hurt and who benefits. Some areas will undoubtedly benefit. Other areas, like Bangladesh, will get hit particularly hard. And against all of that, you have a really enormous cost. I mean, slashing what we would have to, you know, something like 20% of our energy use or more, that's a fantastic undertaking. It's going to be enormously expensive in terms of not just consuming less, but also the infrastructure that has to be replaced, the homes in far-flung areas in America that are suddenly worth nothing, and the people who need to have apartments, and the lifestyle changes, and all the rest of it. It's an enormous dislocation that people are saying needs to be done pretty soon. So do I think that we may see some measures that will somewhat cut energy use? Probably. Not only because of global warming, but because of geopolitical issues. But am I confident that because the European Union has nationalized the problem, or supranationalized the problem, really, that they're going to induce that kind of change in their member states? I'm just very, very skeptical, because no government in history, no democratic government in history, certainly, that I'm aware of has ever succeeded in pushing through that kind of massive change on an unwilling citizenry.
Well, we'll see how willing the citizenry is to do this. I guess that's where our argument started, and I guess that's where our argument is likely to end. But one thing which I think should be pointed to, there's a very nice special issue of the Boston Review which talks about these about these things with a, I think, a very, very nice overall statement of what the problem is, of what the state of scientific knowledge is. And one of the things that really comes out, there's a response article by David Victor and a co-author, and another by somebody else whose name I can't remember at the moment. Both of the Victor and co-author piece talks about the problem of coal and of sort of effectively how to deal with the fact that coal is going to be the most abundant source of energy in the future, and also is, by the same token, is the in some ways one of the most polluting sources of energy, and what can be done to do this and to tackle this, and some discussion of the new technologies which are involved there. And the second article is the discussion of China, and clearly what we see at the moment is we see a sort of a whole bunch of new power plants which are being built in China, which are which are effectively built on old-fashioned coal-burning technology, where the carbon footprint that these plants is going to have is going to be pretty terrific and pretty enormous. So this suggests that, at least in this area, there's something which we need to be doing, not today, but yesterday. We need to start trying to figure out how to come up with safer, cleaner coal technologies and carbon containment technologies centered around the use of coal. And we have to figure out ways to persuade the Chinese in particular that when they invest in plant machinery, which is going to be going for 20 or 50 years, that they need to be building in this stuff from the outset rather than trying to rip down what they built 10 or 15 years in the future, or 20 years or 30 years, which is obviously not a lot less likely to happen. And this is something John Quick and my co-blogger has talked about.
I would even broaden that. I think that one of the biggest issues in global warming, and this goes back to sort of what we can do, that second question that I brought up, is that India and China are big, surpass U.S. and Europe as the biggest emitters, not in the not very distant future at all. I mean, with China, we're talking about less than 10 years. And what do you do about those countries, both because you've got these issues of distributional justice, how can the United States tell China that they have to stop their growth and stop people from having cars heat or whatever it is when we have a much, but also simply that the governments of China and India are not going to be interested in global warming until their citizenry is a lot richer than it is now. And I think that for some people on the right, that's become a cop-out. It's basically, well, obviously we don't have to do anything about it because China and India are making this inevitable, and I think that's the wrong way to think about it. But I do think that it's something that should really be guiding where we focus our energy in the policy debate. And for most people in America, I think that a lot of the huge portion of the debate is focused on conservation. It's focused on high standards. It's focused on how to painting people's roofs white and so forth, or forcing people gasoline taxes. And those aren't bad things to do. I'm hugely in favor of a gasoline tax, of a broader energy tax. But what we need to do, if we really want to tackle this problem, is make it attractive and easy for China and India to grow without generating all of this carbon dioxide that's going to pour into the air and warm the planet. And that means that we need to look at things like carbon sequestration for coal plants and funnel money into certain kinds of alternative energy projects. It tends to be done very willy-nilly in the U.S. And to some extent in Europe, but really think about possible abatement strategies such as spraying clouds with salt water. Those sorts of things where we can take action independent of China and India and make a difference, and looking at those areas, because otherwise there is a real sense in which Western action is futile because energy resources are fungible, and if the U.S. and Europe stop consuming, all you're doing is making more available for India and China to consume. You're not actually stopping the consumption of these resources.
Well, I think on that we can reach some agreement that at least there's some stuff there which is possible to do. As to the broader question of how to change the attitudes of the public in the West, Bruce Sterling has a pretty interesting argument from a couple of years ago that effectively what we need to be doing in a certain sense is making green stuff fashionable. He calls this the Viridian movement, and I think, for example, there's a lot of hype about SUVs, which clearly, while they contribute in some ways to the problem, aren't necessarily sort of all that. So when you look at the contribution, for example, of air travel, SUVs sort of aren't even in the races. But nonetheless, the fact that SUVs have been somewhat unfairly demonized may actually point to a possible strategy of sort of making certain consumer lifestyle choices unfashionable, unsexy, and trying to change the culture that way.
I'm happy to try. I certainly, I don't have a car. I live in urban areas. I live near public transit, and for a lot of reasons, but they include the fact that I think it's the moral choice given the environmental issues. But I would just point out that for all of the demonizing of SUVs, Americans sure drive a lot of them, and the thing that pushed them out of the SUVs wasn't nearly so much social opprobrium as it was the high cost of gasoline. So I welcome any attempts to use non-coercive, non-government means to change people's ways, but I'm not sure how far you're going to get with that one.
Well, maybe not that far, but who knows?
Any port in the storm, right?
Any port in the storm. Okay, so next topic I think was going to be, and I think indeed in a previous incarnation was democratic populism.
Yes.
How we started the conversation, as I recall, was, I read this piece which your colleagues Micklethwaite and Wooldridge wrote for the Wall Street Journal a couple of years ago, which effectively was all about how the Republican right and sort of ought to be cheered up because it basically still was winning the war on ideas, that the ideas which were out there were Republican ideas, were conservative ideas. And I don't know what they think about this today, but I don't think that that's true anymore. If you look at the way that the policy debate seems to be shifting, it seems to be shifting towards populism in different ways on the left and on the right, but I think we're seeing a clear move towards that. Now, as an old-fashioned lefty, while not all of this is is something that I like, there's clearly a lot of it that I do like, but I suspect that you probably fall on the other side of a whole bunch of these issues, so maybe we can talk through them.
Well, I have to say, it's not that the editor-in-chief confides in me terribly often, but, my publication and I both have basically the same attitude about a lot of these issues, such as free trade and government intervention in the economy and so forth. And the fact is, I am very unhappy at the direction that I see the Democrats and to a lesser extent the Republicans taking. I'm not pleased at the sight of a wealthy, prosperous America deciding that the real problem with everyone's lives is brown people somewhere else who just are too willing to work for too little. I assume that you're not happy about that, but I don't actually know your position on trade.
My position on trade is pretty straightforward. I'm pretty happy about free trade. I would like to see more labor standards and environmental standards and trade agreements. I don't see why, if, for example, intellectual property standards are being imposed on countries in the developing world, why labor standards shouldn't be there as well. And this is a whole other debate I'm sure we could get into. But that caveat aside, I'm basically in favor of free trade. What I would like to see is much more in the way of social protection to balance out free trade insofar as possible and to effectively ensure that some of the disruptions that untrammeled markets are causing for people to get
hit. Well, I think one of the issues that we got into last time, and we might as well just bite the bullet and go for it, is the minimum wage, which is, of course, the Democrats' so far major populist achievement.
Well, do you want to start in on your side on the minimum wage?
Well,
or should I start
you go
this,
ahead.
This
time, I think I started last time.
Okay. Well, I see the minimum wage as being a. I'm in favor of what's happened. The empirical evidence on the effects of the minimum wage seem at best to be muddy as to whether it causes sort of very much in the way of increased unemployment, and the effects, I would suspect, on the bargaining position of the people who are involved in, at the lower end of the wage spectrum, not only limited to those people who are on the minimum wage itself, but those for whom the minimum wage is in an important sense a kind of a bottom limit, the effects, while hard to measure, are arguably quite significant. And here, this is not just me arguing this. This is a whole bunch, 650-odd economists, including Nobel Prize winners such as Bob Solow and Kenneth Arrow, who I think more than anybody else is the person who has developed modern ideas of market equilibrium. And these people are saying that that moderate increases in the minimum wage are justifiable, workers vis-a-vis their employers.
Well, I think it's interesting, right? Because everyone keeps studying the 650 economists, and yet there are thousands, tens of thousands of economists out there, and a very small number of them sign this. And I don't think that there is anywhere near. I find it really interesting, actually, to sort of read left-wing blogs, and the assumption that there is a consensus on this stuff, and that there are these crazy right-wing holdouts who hate the minimum wage, but everyone else knows that Card and Kruger have proved that it's okay, which is a just gross, wild exaggeration of the state of the data. I mean, I agree with you. I think that if you mounted sort of what you could sketch is really a very broad consensus on the minimum wage is that small effects of the minimum wage probably create some disappointment, but that the effect is too small to reliably tease out of the numbers, because economic data is extremely noisy, and it's especially noisy in the segments of the economy that employ minimum wage workers. You know, those labor markets are extremely, they're all over the place, they're extremely responsive to local economic conditions and so forth. I think the next item of consensus that you would get is that probably, to the extent that there is redistribution, a lot of it does, however, come from the people who are unemployed are the weakest and most vulnerable members of the low-wage labor force. So that the people who are most likely to be pushed out would be people like young black males, people with criminal records, people who have an employment gap due to, for example, possibly a housewife who exited the labor market, but more likely someone who, say, had a drug problem and didn't work for 4 years. Those people are the least likely to be employed. They're the people who are most likely to be laid off, or not laid off. They're the people who are most likely to not be hired in the first place. Because I really doubt, you know, what you're going to see is anyone getting fired because of the minimum wage. What you're going to see is, on the one hand, possibly some businesses closing because their profits have gotten to the point now where the proprietors simply, you know, have better uses for their time and capital. And also the substitution of labor-saving machines that result in eventually people not getting hired. And because turnover in these markets is so quick, you don't actually need anyone to get fired to see disappointment effects. The third item of consensus, I think, it's not even debatable. You know, there's excellent data on this from the census, is that the number of people who are poor who are helped by a minimum wage increase is extremely small. It's something under 20% of the low-wage labor force. So I would say that the minimum wage is a policy that is supposed to be targeting poor people, people who need help. And in fact, it ends up being an enormous handout to people like middle-class teenagers, probably at the expense of vulnerable workers. Probably some of the money comes out of corporate pockets, but you know, it really depends on the labor market conditions. And if the labor market is so bad now that workers can't bargain, then I have a hard time believing that the companies are going to front the money rather than, for example, turning down the air conditioning or forcing people to work harder. And you know, maybe that's a great thing. Now we've forced everyone to be twice as productive, but if people had wanted to be twice as productive, they could have done that before and presumably gotten a better job. I think Greg Mankiw has the sort of neatest summation of this. He says this is a program that is supposed to help low-wage workers, paid for by a tax on low-wage workers. And you know, no economist would say it's ideal. And when I talk to economists about it, as one Democratic economist that I was talking to at AEA said, he said, you know, even economists who support the minimum wage, they're kind of sheepish about it. They're not happy about it. They feel like more should be done for low-wage workers, and they don't feel like they have political support to do the things that they would like to do, so they support this as like an eighth best alternative. But in fact, I think we have a first best alternative, which is the Earned Income Tax Credit, which if people keep saying, you know, I talk about the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is basically, for any viewers who don't know, it's a refundable tax credit so that if you are a poor worker, you'll get several thousand dollars back at the end of the year. I mean, it can end up being like 30% of your income. It's a really substantial boost to people's paychecks. And I talk about this to people on the left, and they say, oh, well, but a program for poor is a poor program. And in fact, the EITC has more consensus than the minimum wage. Every time we've had a tax bill in the last 10 years, it's been increased. It's been a huge success. Everyone loves it. And why would we have this eighth best program instead of the earned income tax credit? I frankly don't really understand it very well.
Well, the other side of that is that why are all these sheepish economists not coming out in favor of the earned income tax credit? I like the earned income tax credit. I think it's a great program. I also think that it's a somewhat limited program. But to get back to
I would just say that they do. I mean, you know, why are they not? Everyone loves the income tax credit. It's just that it's not contentious. The reason that there aren't signed petitions circulating is that every time it comes up in Congress, it passes, and there aren't think tanks that need to go out and do this because it happens. And you know, the only reason they're not coming out in consensus of it, in favor of it, is that no one is asked. If you circulated a petition, I bet you could get a lot more than 650 names on it.
Yeah, but the point that I want to get back to is the point about the data. And the data is, as you say, extremely messy, extremely problematic, extremely difficult to come to any conclusions about. And perhaps as a result of this, we've got this incredibly, I'm reading different blogs than you are, but I see a different account of Kardon-Kruger. You know, so I see an account of Kardon-Kruger which doesn't emphasize necessarily that they are the be-all and end-all, but that there are at the very least two sides to this debate. And it's an extremely bitter debate, as you see for the fact that Card effectively refuses to talk in public about it anymore because he feels that he's lost too many friends. And you see Neumark, or Newmark, I'm not sure how he pronounces his name, claiming that the reason he didn't get a job in Berkeley is because Card specifically dinged his application. So, you know, you get these extremely bitter fights happening around the minimum wage and the measurement, econometrics of the minimum wage, which I think help go some degree to explain the sheepishness that you refer to. But we also get, as I say, 650 economists, including many who, by any standard, are among the key luminaries of the field, effectively saying that this is a good thing. And we had a discussion when we talked last time. We were talking about the Neumark and Nitsilova paper on the effects of which you were arguing provided some evidence to suggest to say that the minimum wage had effects on people's long-term earning paths. And I took a look at the paper in the meantime, and it doesn't seem to me to be all that much in the way of good dispositive evidence. If you look at the way that they come up with what appears to be a pretty strong effect, but then when they control for the, when they try to put in a basic control for economic conditions, a lot of the effect seems to evaporate, in some cases below the level of statistical significance, in some cases at the 0.1 level of statistical significance, which is below the standards that you usually get, that are usually considered acceptable for publication in social sciences. And you get Sir Alex Tabarrok, who I think is about as far from being a minimum wage proponent as you could imagine, saying that he likes the paper because it seems to agree with his priors, but that the data problems are clearly something that give him a lot of pause. And the most that he can come to say is, well, this is the start of what may be an interesting debate. And I think this is where we are. These effects are putative. It may be that these effects are real. It's quite plausible that these effects are real, but it's also quite plausible that the costs of the minimum wage are in fact not all that large compared to the benefits. And certainly, the econometric data out there doesn't seem to me to be strong enough.
As I would say that I don't see that the benefits are large, given how few people who earn it are poor. Number one, because I'm not interested in any, and this is again possibly where we differ, I'm not interested in any social program that redistributes money from anyone to the middle class. The middle class, and they have adequate everything they need. I'm really not interested in making sure the middle class teenagers have more money to go to the movies or buy shoes or whatever it is they do with it. Teenagers and very young workers is really what we're talking about here. Over half of the people who are in the minimum wage are under the age of 24. So do I care that middle-class college students, you know, have to eat ramen instead of going down to the takeout place? No, I ate ramen. I lived through the experience. So that's number one. I you know, when you say the benefits are large, I don't see that the benefits are large. I see that it's an extraordinarily expensive program, you know, what they call a long run for a short slide. But beyond that, you know, you talk about the Newmark paper, and the Newmark paper is one of a body of work on what happens to people who come into the labor market when demand for their labor is depressed. And it's been, you know, from MBAs that come out during recessions and so forth, that I think that the effects are pretty clear, which is that it has lifetime effects on your earnings. And I say this not happily, because I have an MBA who graduated in 2001, which was a terrible to graduate, and indeed, it has had lifetime effects on my earnings, because if I hadn't lost my job as a management consultant, I wouldn't be a journalist now. On the other hand, I'm happier being a journalist than I would have been being a management consultant, and I think it was the best thing that ever happened to me. But in terms of looking at my earnings, it's definitely clear that that my lifetime earnings are not going to be what the classes before and after me were, and nor will those of my classmates. Similarly, for people who are coming onto the job market in times of low demand, you know, the assumption is that if this depresses demand at all, it is going to push the most vulnerable people out, and that those people, since they're often young black teenagers, that's one of our categories of extremely vulnerable workers, that is going to have a lifetime impact on them. You know, a work history is like a credit history. For someone who doesn't have assets like middle class, you know, connections to get jobs and a college degree, your work history tells future employers, you know, someone kept employing this person for a period of months or years. And that tells them, you know, they don't steal, they show up for work on time and so forth. And when you go to get the next job, you know, even a fast food job tells the next employer for a slightly better job, okay, well, here's someone who's reliable. And that's a big stereotype about any sort of vulnerable worker, from drug users, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, especially if you think about what happens to felons in America, I think it's tragic. They have to put a felony on every, they have to answer yes when they're asked if they've ever committed a felony on a job application, and that usually dings them. Well, if you have a period of high labor demand and they can get some sort of job, if McDonald's is willing to hire them, and the next person can look and say, well, this guy worked at McDonald's for a year and a half, I guess he didn't rob the cash register. Those things are important, and I think that, you know, you are going to see knock-on effects years later. I mean, I think we agree. The data is extremely difficult. It's one of those areas. But what I do see, definitely, there are a lot of liberal bloggers out there who seem to think that the conversation ended with Hardin Kruger, and I definitely think that that isn't true. I think that, you know, the characterization of David Newmark, and I think we probably both read the same article, is that he's pushed the debate back to what is, in essence, you know, are retail as employment minimum wage workers, are they monopsony employers or not? I don't see it, you know, attacking it from another angle. I don't see a credible reason to believe that they are. I don't see how, what plausible mechanism you could say that they are basically a single buyer in the market for labor. If McDonald's and Wendy's are on the street, same street, they're not a single buyer. But, you know, we could go back and forth about that, and probably our readers would all die of boredom. So I'll stop there. And maybe we should move on to national health care, which I'm sure you're itching to get to.
Itching to get to is maybe a misnomer. I'm interested in this stuff, but I'm not a policy wonk. But again, I'm in favor of seeing some move to national health care. And I'm interested in seeing it primarily from the point of view of transaction costs. And here, I'm speaking from the perspective of somebody, I've had experience of the Irish health system, the German health system, the Italian health system, the Canadian health system, and the US health system. I've lived in all of these countries for a period of at least 1 to 2 years. And the amount of transaction costs in the American system that arises primarily and sort of basically from insurance companies seeking effectively to try to deny claims, obviously when at all possible, but also trying to avoid having to deal with bad risks, is to me something which is pretty extraordinary and which is a real and substantial problem. I think Tyler Cowen had a pretty interesting
And for me, intellectually clarifying a post last week where he talks about how this isn't really so much a problem of adverse selection, and I think he's right, but I also think that there's a very fundamental transaction cost problem there with the American system, which I frankly have not seen with any of the other national systems that I've had experience with.
Well, I think we should clarify what we mean when we talk about transaction costs. I mean, I'm not sure that, in fact, what you're talking about is a transaction cost so much as like a hassle that you're getting from your insurance company. It's not a transaction cost if you have to file paperwork to get reimbursed.
It's exactly a it's pretty strong.
From the perspective of insurance, a transaction cost would be I have to hire a lawyer to draw up the contract with the insurance. And in fact, for most people, the transaction costs on getting insurance are extremely low because the for example, either you get it through your employer, in which case no one checks anything, you just sign up with your employer, or you are, most people tend to live, the biggest states in America are states that have community rating, like New York and California, where they're not allowed to ask you any questions anyway, except how old are you and do you smoke. There are a lot of hassles with the U.S. system, but there are a lot of hassles. I mean, part of the problem, right, is that you're young. And the United States system serves the old better than the young. Canada is a great place to live if you aren't sick, if you don't have certain sorts of lifestyle problems that tend to come with getting older. For example, you've never had bypass surgery, I'm assuming. You've never had a hip replaced. All of those things that, from my understanding, again, in the Irish system, in the English system, in the Canadian system, have huge transaction costs, and those transaction, or what you're calling transaction costs, and those transaction costs are, I have to pay for my hip replacement by waiting 18 months to get it. Or in the case of, if you're over 70, by not getting it all. You could argue, is that a transaction cost? You can't do the transaction, they forbid it. Especially in Canada, where you're literally not allowed to go outside the system. Those are huge costs, but they're largely invisible. The costs in America are explicit, and they're much more explicit in some way. I think there's a lot of demonizing from both sides, because I've lived in Britain for a while, I've lived in America. People on both sides just have these crazy ideas about what goes on in the other country. People in America think that, if you get a cold in Britain, you have to wait 9 years to get treatment. And people in Britain think that if you aren't, Bill Gates, basically, and you get hit by a car, they just sort of dump you in the garbage bin if you don't have health insurance. And neither of those sort of stereotypes are true. What is true is that Americans have more direct argument interaction with their healthcare providers and with their insurers than Britons or Irish people do. And it's definitely an upfront hassle. On the other hand, if I'm on a service that my insurer tells me I can't get in the United States, I can argue. If I want that service in Britain, it's just too bad. And that was, there was a case last year where a woman wanted treatment for breast cancer, and it wasn't covered by the NHS. In fact, she eventually got it because she got so many papers arguing in this outraged fashion that she was being denied it. But in fact, lots of other women never got it because the NHS had decided it was too expensive to provide it. That doesn't happen in America. And so, it's a trade-off. Yes, you can eliminate a lot of transaction costs if you have absolutely no recourse if you're denied.
I think there are two different questions here. One is, when I think about transaction costs, what I was primarily thinking about was the sort of degree to which, for example, doctor's offices in the U.S. have to hire several people, have to hire two or three people whose basic job is sort of interfacing with the insurance companies, with different insurance companies, and with their different requirements for information and so on. And this is these are a set of costs which are definitely transaction costs, and which are not characteristic, I think, to anywhere near the same extent of the other healthcare systems that I've had contact with. And again, here I'm talking semi-anecdotally, but only semi-anecdotally, because this is something which, as I say, is not a direct, it's not a burning passion of mine, but it's something where I certainly was interested in reading about while I was there. But the second thing is that when you're talking about the sort of hip replacement thing, that seems to me to be less a question of transaction costs than a question of rationing. And the argument as to whether sort of the rationing of expensive operations is worse in Britain or in the US is, I think, it's pretty hard to say, because certainly if you have money and or if you have an extremely good health insurance provider in the US, there is a lot of stuff that is open to you that is open with a lot of difficulty in Britain or Canada or in other systems. But the key sort of thing here is if you've got a lot of money or if you've got a great insurance provider, and that is sort of by no means...
I'm not sure it is hard to say, right? Like, we know how much these services are provided in the United States versus how much they're provided in other countries, and there's more provided here. So, you know, is it hard to say whether hip replacements are more rationed here than in Canada if we do twice as many of them? No, it's not. I don't have the actual figures, but in fact, like, the waiting times for procedures are shorter in the United States, and there are a lot more procedures done, there are a lot more tests done. We can argue about whether that's efficient or so forth, but it's not hard to argue about the rationing part. There is more rationing in other countries, that's why their healthcare is cheaper.
Well, I would like to see sort of some...
I mean, I don't think the Canadians have severely less demand for, say, replaced hips than the United States do. Than people in the United States do. I doubt that people in France, you know, want fewer MRIs than people in the U.S.
But there's all, but there are also income differences between these countries which have to be controlled for as well.
The income differences, yeah, that's true, but I'm not sure how useful that is. I mean, for one thing, it should be cutting the other. Everyone's arguing how terrible it is that it's rationed in the United States. By price, so the income difference should actually be cutting towards the socialized medicine people. But beyond that, you know, the differences are huge. They're not small. You know, Canada, we have like 6 or 10 or some large number more MRI machines than Canada does. That's not a function of the fact that Canada's GDP is six times is only 1/6 what ours is. You know, the differences in the supply of healthcare are extremely large, and they almost entirely account for the differences in the cost of healthcare.
Well, just a question: would you prefer to be a say a lower middle class worker in retail from the point of view of a sort of healthcare provision in country?
Okay, but now we're getting into different. First of all, I don't know, because I've never been a lower middle class worker in either place. But, you know, would I prefer to be someone who works for one of the 85% of Americans who is insured in the United States or in France? No question. Absolutely no question that I would prefer to be an American. Now, if we knock out the illegal immigrants and the wealthy people who, for one reason or another, are choosing not to to be insured, you end up with, I think, probably about 7.5% of Americans uninsured. Leave them aside for a moment, like just in terms of the people who have health insurance, there's no question that I would prefer to be an American. I know my English friends think that American healthcare is ridiculous. It's like being in the hospital here is like being in a hotel. I would prefer to be in a hotel. Now, going on to the 7.5% who don't have health insurance, I've been uninsured, in fact. And would I have preferred to be uninsured here? Than in France. If I could have bought catastrophic insurance, I would have preferred to be me uninsured here. Because the level of care that I got from my doctors when I was uninsured was extraordinary. What I was not, I wasn't having a problem with financing my healthcare. What I was having a problem with was the fact that if I got hit by a car, I would have to go bankrupt. But the question for me was never, like, was I going to get health care? I was pretty sure that if I got cancer, a hospital would treat me, because a lot of people who have cancer do bust through their insurance caps, and the oncologists keep treating them. The question was, would I have to go bankrupt in order to get out of the bill?
You're talking from the perspective of somebody who, I presume, as I do, has reasonably good health care through their employer. This isn't necessarily true if you're
working
for... No,
I'm speaking of me when I was uninsured. I was a freelancer for 3 years.
I know, but I'm returning to the first part of the thing where we were talking about the lower middle class worker. There are vast differences between different healthcare plans in the U.S., and I think this is especially so with the push on under the Bush administration and under previous Republican administrations towards health saving accounts as being an alternative form of healthcare provision, and towards
honestly, you compare. It's part. Okay, so there's two questions here. Like, number one is, would I prefer to have someone else pay for my health care? Yeah. I would prefer to have someone else pay for every aspect of my life. And if I were a lower middle class worker somewhere, would I prefer that people gave me money? I would prefer that people give me money now. But are we talking about the quality of service? Because lower middle class people with healthcare plans that they don't particularly care for get the same posh American hospitals. They get the fact that there are no open wards in America, as far as I can tell, unlike, for example, the NHS. They get that even if they don't like their crappy HMO. They get all the MRIs. They get all of the lab tests. They get all of the machines. They get all of the drugs. They get all of that stuff, even if what they complain about is they don't like the hassle, right? They don't like to hassle with their insurance company. They don't like that they can't choose their doctor. They don't like that they have to get on the phone and argue or whatever. But it's not about the quality of the service. I don't think there's really much question in anyone's mind that the quality of the service in the United States is better than anywhere else in the world, which is why I have never heard of an American, you know, other than a few sort of extremely specialized clinics for some extremely specialized diseases, Americans don't go abroad to get treated. People come here. And that service is, in fact, surprisingly available. There's definitely regional variations and so forth, but sort of the level of minimum care that's expected in a U.S. hospital is extremely high. And so would I rather be here? Yeah, I would rather be here. I would rather be in my posh hotel hospital getting my unnecessary 6 MRIs and my hip replacement at the age of 75. Than I would be in Canada on a waiting list or told that, you know, I'm sorry, you're just too old for that operation.
Well, I'm not sure that this is altogether a realistic perspective on what people with plain Jane health care provision can expect. So I agree that I agree on the question of hospital wards and whatever, but on the question of those of access to some of the services, my understanding is that there, you know, so especially when it comes to healthcare savings accounts, there are some real differences. But I'm running out of tape here, so we've got about 2.5 minutes left. So is there anything? Oh yeah, one further thing I wanted to ask you about, which is something we talked about in the previous conversation, but that I was thinking about afterwards, which is you were talking about about drug prices and effectively about about how it was that it was a wonder that U.S. the high U.S. drug prices were an effective subsidy to the rest of the world. And I was just wondering, is this that you're talking about, and you're also talking about how you basically agreed with the Economist, with your employer on this and on a bunch of issues with regards to free markets. But this is clearly an area where you're talking about the need to maintain a kind of an artificial market. In other words, this is a market which cannot be maintained unless you have effective barriers on the import of cheaper drugs from elsewhere. So I'm not saying that this is a gotcha, but how do you reconcile the contradiction? Under what circumstances are artificial market arrangements like this acceptable to you? Under what circumstances?
Well, I mean, I would go back to, first of all, intellectual property markets are tough. The cost of manufacturing a pill is, for all, a drug in almost all cases, is the cost of discovering it. The cost of making the first, making the second pill after you made the first one, the cost is trivial. And that leads to a lot of temptation to steal, right? Someone else could make the drug very cheaply, not have your research costs, and make profits competing with you who have to actually recover your research costs and what you charge for the drug. And that's why we have intellectual property markets. I think what happens in drug markets, it seems pretty clear to me that the rich world governments, when they are negotiating with drug companies, there is at least some implicit threat that if you do not sell to me at a price I like, I will break the patent and I will allow someone else to produce your drug. And that allows them to batter down the prices. Do I think that's moral? Not particularly. I don't think that that's moral. I, being that I make my living by intellectual property,
but
I have pretty strong feelings about what people should be allowed to see what I create.
Is that really true? Under TRIPS, as I understand it, you can threaten to manufacture patented drugs but only sort of when you can demonstrate that there's some sort of national emergency, such as AIDS or whatever, which you're seeking to tackle.
My understanding of the law is that that's true, but my understanding of just looking at these markets and how far the prices have gone down, it seems clear to me that the patent threat and the right of exit threat, depending on what drug you're talking about, have brought the prices down well below where it would be. So given that, you know,
it's a realistic
practical question here for me about drugs and medical technology and all the rest of it, right? You can bite the bullet and say, look, in order to have drugs, we need to have profitable markets. And it needs to be profitable for someone to make them. They need to have an incentive to make them. And you can, as, for example, my ex-boyfriend, ardent liberal that he was, said, you know what, I think you're right, and I don't care. I think I want to give drugs to people now who need them. For me, that's not a good trade-off, because if you look at the, say, 15 or 20 million people in the United States who could be covered by a national prescription plan, who don't now have access to prescription drugs or may not have access to prescription drugs, and you compare those to the hundreds of millions of people who have diseases that we can't or will have in the future, I mean the billions of people in the future who have diseases that we can't currently cure and die of them, it just doesn't even come close in terms of utilitarian.
Well, I guess the rejoinder to that is a whole bunch of these diseases, you know, there's not very much incentive for drug companies to tackle bilharzia and similar things that don't afflict rich middle-class consumers in the Western world. But that's a whole different debate. I'm running out of time here on my machine, so is it okay if we wrap things up for
today? Absolutely. It's been a pleasure.
Okay. And likewise.
And hopefully I'll see you. Get to see you before I leave D.C.
Hopefully so. A coffee or a lunch or whatever suits.
Excellent.
Okay.
Take care.
And hopefully we actually manage to upload this
system. Your lips to God's ears.
Okay, fingers crossed. Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye, Megan.